Okay, the court is now ready for oral arguments in the second case on today's calendar. That case is case number A24-0584, State of Minnesota versus Allison Renee Rolfe. Counsel should be aware that our procedure today is equivalent to what it would be in the courtroom, even though we are conducting the argument by Zoom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and then begin your argument.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is David Lundgren and I represent the appellant, Allison Renee Rolfe. Ms. Rolfe has raised two issues in this appeal. With regard to the first issue, she asks this court to find that her guilty plea was inaccurate and remand the matter to the district court with instructions to the district court to allow her to withdraw her plea. Because the state has conceded that her guilty plea was inaccurate and the matter should be remanded to allow her to withdraw her plea, the majority of my time today will be spent discussing the second issue that Ms. Rolfe has raised, unless the court has any questions pertinent to the first issue. The second issue raised
I
by
do.
Ms. Rolfe.
I do have Mr. Glamour, and I guess I do have a question or two about the first issue. And I guess I hesitate to question resolution that is agreed upon by the parties. But I'm just wondering why. I mean, if significant relationship was an element of the offense, and if she admitted to significant relationship, why we need to inquire further? Why do we need to, I mean, have facts underlying facts? Why do we need to know the specific facts? I mean, I think significant relationship could be a factual issue in itself. It depends upon other facts, predicate facts, maybe more specific facts, historical. I mean, significant relationship is a term of art. But it exists if there are certain predicate facts, and one of them is that parties have resided together. But in a guilty plea, I mean, the defendant comes forward and wishes to admit guilt to relieve the state of its burden of proof, and so on. I mean, I'm just wondering, why do we need to have the predicate facts in the record if we have the ultimate fact in the record?
I think there are two important reasons why, especially with regard to the term significant relationship specifically. The first reason would be a significant relationship on its face is not the meaning of that, the legal definition of that is not apparent. It's, defined by statute to provide the, at that point in time, the three predicate factual scenarios that could satisfy that legal definition. In comparison to like a term like sexual penetration, that term on its face is readily apparent. When you say sexual penetration, people understand what that means. However, when you say
Now
the terms.
let me stop you there because that was my next question. I was going to say sexual penetration is defined by statute. It's in 609.341 sub 12. It has a long definition of sexual penetration. But so I mean by your theory, I mean do we need to insist on an admission by the defendant of every particular physical act that occurred? In other words, I mean, could you just as well argue that the factual record is inaccurate because it lacks specific factual information about the penetration, so that we can assure ourselves that the definition of sexual penetration has been satisfied?
That argument could be made. It's not made in this specific case, but it certainly could be made, and it would meet the best practices that has been outlined by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court in how guilty plea, the factual basis for guilty plea should be entered. And that is to ask the defendant in his or her own words what occurred rather than asking leading questions. And the That best practice to have the defendant explain in his or own words what occurred is to get those details to make sure that what factually occurred meets the necessary elements of the offense. Because as Your Honor noted, by pleading guilty, it is relieving the state of its burden of proof to prove that person's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So there has to be actual facts rather than just admissions to, legal definition elements of what constitutes a criminal offense. And I use the term, the comparison between sexual penetration and significant relationship because I think most people, from just a common sense standpoint, when they hear the term sexual penetration, that aligns with the legal definition. But when you talk about a significant relationship as it's defined in 609.341, I think a lot of people could have different understandings of what a significant relationship means, and not necessarily align with what the legal definition is. But more importantly, here is the district court's limitation on what significant relationship meant. It wasn't just a general, do you have a significant relationship with this person? It was a leading question that said, do you share a significant relationship, i.e., and then further inquired about the relationship that she had, the romantic relationship that she had with the minor child's parent. And so it wasn't just, do you have a significant relationship? It was specific to the romantic relationship that Miss Rolfe had with the minor child's father, which at that time did not satisfy the legal definition for significant relationship. And I think that
Well,
limitation is critical here.
I guess we don't. I mean, are you saying that, as a matter of fact, they did not reside together?
I'm saying that was not admitted at the plea colloquy.
But could the district court infer that if these two people were in a romantic relationship, and if she agreed that there was a significant relationship between her and the boy, couldn't the district court infer the facts that are necessary for a significant relationship finding?
I don't believe there's the necessary facts in the plea colloquy that would allow that inference. There are many people, just because some two people share a romantic relationship with one another does not mean that they reside with one another.
I agree with that, but if I say, I have a significant relationship with person X, and excuse me, yeah, I have a romantic relationship with person X, and I have a significant relationship under the law with X's child, then I think the district court could draw an inference of the missing step in the sequence, but in the chain of logic, but.
Yeah, and I would respectfully disagree with that interpretation just because there's nothing creating that. The question that was posed to Miss Rolfe was a direct question of, do you have a significant relationship? Specifically, you share a romantic relationship with the minor child's father. Not anything more than that. It was a direct question about, and there was specificity provided about the romantic relationship and nothing with regard to residence or where they resided or had they ever lived with one another. So that the to jump from a romantic relationship to inferring that they've lived with one another, I think is not connected close enough.
I
Am I
appreciate.
correct? Oh, sorry.
I'm no, go ahead, Judge Wheelock.
Am I correct that your argument is that because they provided an example of a type of relationship or significant relationship, that you're suggesting that it was limited only to the example provided and that we can't just take that as an, I mean, I guess I'd rate it as here's a significant relationship, here's one type of them. It's not necessarily limiting.
Yeah, so the reason that it is limiting is because the term IE. IE means that is, means it's Latin for id est, which is another way of saying specifically. So do you share a significant relationship, specifically a romantic relationship with the father, rather than the term EG, which would be an example. You know, if you're, that would be saying, I'm providing you one of many possible examples of what I'm asking you about. But that term isn't the term that was used by the district court. The district court asked specifically about that type of
Right. And I
situation.
understand the difference between the two different designations. I guess I'm thinking that the district court is having a conversation and they aren't with somebody who isn't probably familiar with the differences and the origins of the Latin terminology. And so it's a not a such a precise conversation in that regard. And that the intent was so as in an EG. Here's an example of one. So I'm not sure. I read it the same way that you do, but that's okay.
Thank you.
My next question, I see your time is winding down. I know you wanted to get to the next issue. My question for you is, if we were to agree with you about the inaccuracy of the plea, do we even reach the second issue or the second argument that appellant makes here about the alleged bias of the court?
This court certainly, it would not be necessary to reach that issue if the court agrees with the parties on the first issue. However, I do think it would or could inform the instructions on remand. Candiolo High County is a small county and there's three assigned judicial officers to that county. And it's quite possible that Judge Fisher would be assigned to hear the matter on remand if the court does not reach the second issue and find that there was an appearance of partiality. And so I think a decision from this court on the second issue would be helpful and beneficial just in terms of judicial economy, because if the matter is remanded and Judge Fisher is assigned to any future hearings in the matter, there would likely be a disqualification motion based on that prior appearance of partiality that's been raised on appeal by Ms. Rolfe. And on that topic, you know, I'd like to discuss the two main points that the state has raised with regard to its arguments about why there was not an appearance of partiality. First, the state suggests that appellant could have easily obtained a psychosexual evaluation on her own, and therefore it was a tactical decision on behalf of appellant to not request one. And second, the state suggests that the lack of a psychosexual evaluation was not the only reason that the court gave in denying the dispositional departure motion. With regard to the state's first argument, it's true that appellant could have obtained a psychosexual on her own, independent of any order by the court, and that's not in dispute. However, that argument, I think, misses the mark because it ignores the statutory obligation that the district court had to order a psychosexual evaluation unless the district court decided to waive it. This statutory obligation placed the district court in a decision-making role about whether an evaluation needed to be done and completed by appellant. If there wasn't that statutory obligation, then I think this would be a non-issue and the district court could have been able to remain fair, neutral, and impartial in denying appellant's dispositional departure, but those aren't the circumstances here. In addressing the appearance of partiality, it is viewed by a reasonable examiner. And in other words, that's an objective, unbiased layperson with full knowledge of the facts and circumstances. And I think here, an objective and unbiased layperson would not overlook the role the district court played in waiving the psychosexual evaluation that would have otherwise been required by statute, and then relying upon that lack of an evaluation in large part to deny appellant's motion. The state's second argument that the lack of a psychosexual evaluation was not the only reason that the district court denied appellant's dispositional departure motion also misses the mark. Appellant concedes that there were other reasons given, but those other reasons do not purge the appearance of partiality that was created by the district court's implicit waiver of the psychosexual evaluation. The lack of a psychosexual evaluation was the primary reason that the district court gave in denying the motion. The district court began its explanation of its denial with that reason. A reasonable examiner.
Lundgren, I'm curious to know if the court had ordered the psychosexual examination, is that something where the cost of the examination would have been covered by someone other than appellant? And if appellant had gone out and obtained a psychosexual evaluation on her own, would that have, I mean, what is there a difference there in terms of who would bear the cost?
I can't speak specific to Kandy OI County, but I do know that in other counties, the cost of a psychosexual evaluation is still required to be paid by the defendant, but it is often reduced. So there is a lesser cost to the defendant if it is ordered by the court rather than obtaining an independent psychosexual evaluation.
And couldn't the appellant have requested the district court to go ahead and order it instead of waive it if she had wanted it?
That request certainly could have been made.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I see my time is finished.
Thank you, Mr. Lundgren. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Thank you, Shane Baker for Kandy OI County, State of Minnesota. Certainly, it's an unusual position to say we're conceding an issue. It was one of those things where, when I got the brief, was starting to draft it, you start to figure out how do you rebut the challenges. And I was finding myself quickly in a position where I didn't think that was possible. We looked at the plea petition because that's a part of a plea. Sometimes there's facts put in there that would help. There's nothing there. I looked. The case law said you can infer certain facts, and the plea colloquy was so limited, it was about a page of transcript. There's very few facts given. And then a final issue on that point is, I guess the way I'm understanding the court's questions, it would almost be like an assault plea where all the defendant says, "Yes, I assaulted this person," without nothing more. They take the legal term, say yes, they did, they on that. And I don't know if that would be sufficient. And at least for significant relationship, one thing I think that differentiates this is there was the law change. It used to, well, currently, the question the court asked would be sufficient, that this is a child of your romantic partner. That would meet the new change that occurred in 2021. So what I can't know is whether the attorney used the current law and had their conversation with the defendant under that review of the facts, or whether they used the law that was actually in effect when the act was committed. And I know it's frustrating on my end that that fact was right in the complaint where it says they live together, but and that's why I came to the decision of conceding issue one. On issue two, I don't think we even need to get there. But if there's thought that we need to go there, I don't think, in looking at how the judge articulates it, I don't see it as Mr. Lundgren has articulated that she used the fact of not doing a psychosexual as something she held against Ms. Rolfe. It was more the judge is talking about, and I believe this starts on page 33 of the sentencing transcript. I'm looking for a particular amenability, not just amenability, particular amenability. And then she's looking at all the types of things that Ms. Rolfe was doing, and she said those fell short. She listed psychosexual eval, but she also listed sex offender treatment and other actions. I think the judge was looking at the whole situation and not just simply implicitly waiving the requirement and then using that as a basis to not grant a departure.
Mr. Baker, does the fact that the alleged bias occurred during the sentencing and not during earlier in the proceedings, does that make a difference here in whether or not we should reach it? Any thoughts on that?
No, I don't think so, because it could also be where lack of action, it's almost like between, I think it's hypothetically possible for bias to arise between a plea and sentence, where a person, a judge, is looking for more from an offender and nothing develops. So I don't think the timing somehow avoids addressing the issue. I just think, obviously, if it's remanded to address the plea, we'd certainly cover whether to do a psychosexual at that time.
Thank
And I
you.
think that's the difference for the fact that the judge is looking at the issue of particular amenability, says she's open to what is this defendant's particular situation. And she hasn't foreclosed thoughtful reflection on where Ms. Rolfe may be if that information was provided later. And I have nothing else unless there are other questions.
It appears there are no further questions or for you, Mr. Baker. Thank you very much.
Thank
And we
you.
do appreciate when appellate counsel are candid in their presentation of issues and giving concessions when appropriate. So we appreciate that. Counsel for appellant, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, I think with regard to the timing of when this issue occurred at the sentencing hearing, this case is similar to this court's decision in Weidenbach, which was detailed on page 30 and 31 of appellant's brief. And that was a case where it was a co-defendant case, and the defendant appeared for a sentencing hearing, and there was a motion for a durational departure made by that defendant. And the district court in that case looked at the pre-sentence investigation of the defendant's co-defendant to determine that the basis advanced for the durational departure, meaning that he was a minor or passive participant in the offense, was not supported by the co-defendant's pre-sentence investigation, and that those facts that were outside of the record were introduced by the judge and described in detail and in denying the defendant's durational departure argument in that case. And I think the district court's actions in this case by waiving the psychosexual evaluation that would otherwise be required by statute, and then beginning the denial of the dispositional departure motion by explaining that she's denying it because the appellant did not complete a psychosexual evaluation. I think those factual scenarios are very similar and analogous. I think that supports appellant's position here that there is an appearance of partiality. Unless the court has any questions, that would concede or that would conclude my remarks. Thank you.
I guess, why do you believe, or why is there reason for anyone to reasonably believe that the district court's way of handling this issue was due to bias as opposed to just maybe inadvertence or a misunderstanding about what's required? I mean, seems like you could have presented an argument that the district court erred by not arguing. Excuse me, by not ordering an independent professional assessment, period, without respect to motive. And it seems like, if we were to accept your argument, it might sort of convert any, potentially, any type of error by a district judge into a matter of judicial bias.
Yeah, I would again respectfully disagree that any, error by the district court would lead to an argument of an appearance of partiality. Here, I think the critical thing is that the district court was in a decision-making role on that waiver, that it required not just, a decision, but an action to waive the psychosexual evaluation. And I also, I very carefully considered the oversight or just inadvertence and the back and forth at the plea hearing. The district court's questions at the plea hearing cut against that, because at the time of Ms. Rolfe's plea, the district court specifically asked her, "Did you complete a psychosexual evaluation?" And the district court, and the response was no. And then the district court, instead of ordering a psychosexual evaluation, only ordered a pre-sentence investigation. And so it was an issue that was considered by the court at the time of Ms. Rolfe's plea about whether or not to order a psychosexual evaluation. And that issue did come up. And, you know, just to be clear also, you know, I'm, you know, appellant's position is not that there is actual bias, because it's, that's not what the standard requires. It's just an appearance of partiality, not that there was actual bias that was held by the judge. And so it doesn't, the standard is not that she was biased against Ms. Rolfe, just that a reasonable examiner might reasonably question the judge's impartiality. And I do believe that the circumstances and facts that existed in this case do lead to that conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundgren. It appears there are no further questions. So this case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.